Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. We are often asked how people become members of our virtual congregation. We know that hundreds of people use our website and download our audio content, but most of them remain anonymous users. Others, however, reciprocate by becoming regular donors to Beth Emmanuel. We consider those people as virtual members of the community. If we have become your long-distance community, please consider supporting Beth Emmanuel by clicking on the Donate tab at BethEmmanuel.org.
All right, so we are in the season of the counting of the Omer, and some of you know what that means, and some of you do not, and that's okay. I'll explain it just very briefly. You see, the scriptures, the Torah prohibits the using or eating of any produce from the New Year's cereal crops in the land of Israel until the priesthood offers up to the Lord the first of the new grain. So the barley crop ripens first. So the priesthood always brought in a sheaf, that is an omer, a unit of measure, an omer of barley to present to God as fine flour and as a bread offering to the Lord in his temple. And so this commandment of the barley omer reminded Israel that the whole harvest belongs to God. And until the people harvested this first fruits, this first barley, omer, in the temple, the rest of the crops were not even kosher. They weren't considered permissible to eat. So on the first day after the first day of Passover, the priesthood brought this omer of barley to the temple, and then starting that day, the Torah says, you shall count off the days, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and so on and so forth, all the way up to 49 days, and then the 50th day is Shavuot, 50, Pentecost, the next appointment on the Lord's calendar. So here's how it went down in the year of our Master's suffering, in the days of our Master's suffering. On the same day that Caiaphas and his associates tried the Master in that trial in the house of Caiaphas, three apostles from the Sanhedrin went out into a barley field not far from Jerusalem. And on the same day that the Romans bound and crucified the Master, the apostles from the Sanhedrin bound up standing barley into bundles while it was still attached to the ground so that it would be easier to reap. Then, a day later, Saturday night, they returned to the barley field after the conclusion of the first day of Passover, and crowds from the local village gathered to witness the ceremony out in the field. And so these apostles from the Sanhedrin would brandish these big sickles, and they would turn to the crowd and they would say, even though it was the Shabbat, they had carried these sickles. Think about that. And so they would turn to the crowd and they would say, has the sun set? And the people would all reply, hein, which is yes. And then they would say, has the sun set? And the people would all say, hein. And then they would say, has the sun set? And the people would all say, hein. And so they would do this three repetitions, this question and answer three times, and then they would say, shall we cut with this sickle? And they would hold up the sickle, and everybody says, hein, shall we cut with this sickle? Hein, shall we cut with this sickle? Hein, and they keep doing this, and then they say, they cut the barley, and they hold up the basket. Shall we place it in this basket? Hein, and it just keeps going and going like this. And so on and so forth. And in this manner, they complete the ceremony, and then they carry this bundle of grain, this omer barley, back to Jerusalem that same night. And that same night, the priests in the temple thresh and roast it and grind it into flour. And as they prepared it that same night, you know, that's the same night that our Master left the tomb, and the priests are making this fine, refined flour, sifting it through 13 sieves, they say. And in the morning, when the women were discovering the empty tomb, the priests were offering it up as a barley flour sacrifice in the holy temple. So the Omer begins with the resurrection of the Master, and it concludes with Pentecost 50 days later. That's the idea of this season. It starts with this ritual of bringing the barley, and it concludes them 50 days later at Pentecost, when we would bring the wheat flour to the temple for a similar first fruits sacrifice. And then there's various events throughout the week, as I just mentioned in the announcements, or throughout the 7 weeks. So this Tuesday, 17 days of the Omer, we come to Dag Ba'Omer, which is sort of a joke. The name is sort of a joke that requires some explanation. It's one of those jokes that's not funny by the time you explain it, because it took too much to explain it. But nevertheless, I'll just explain it as a matter of due course. In reality, the Jewish community does not celebrate Dag Ba'Omer. The Jewish community celebrates Lag Ba'Omer on the 33rd day of the counting of the Omer, because it's the yahrzeit of the holy rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. Why is it called Lag Ba'Omer? You might think, well, that's the night we make a bonfire. You throw a log on the fire. It's Lag Ba'Omer. No, that's not it. It's because Lamed is the numeral 30 and Gimel is the numeral 3, and you put them together, it looks like it says log. And so 33rd of the Omer, Lag Ba'Omer. Make sense? All right. So our joke is that we celebrate on the 17th day of the Omer, Dag Ba'Omer. Why is that funny? Well, because it rhymes with log, obviously. And dog means, in Hebrew, dog means fish. That's the important thing that you need to know. So what we're actually saying when we say Dag Ba'Omer, we're saying fish of the Omer, and it's the day that we have the fish breakfast during the counting of the Omer. All right, it doesn't actually correspond to the number, because dog, you know, would be, I suppose the gematria of dog would be 7, which would be, a dalet is 4, a gimel is 3, so dog would be 7, which should be the 7th day of the Omer, which is actually the 8th day of Passover, which is the last time we had fish, which was the Messiah banquet. So it all wraps together, you see. Right? Oh. You would hate to be in my head sometimes. Anyway, in view of the season and the fact that Dag Ba'Omer is this week, and you know, it's a great time. Last time, last time was the time that was the Dag Ba'Omer of the great, the Dag Ba'Omer of the great 2 gallons of Dunn Brothers coffee. That was excellent. And then, of course, there's always the delicious fish. And it's a good time. It's a good time of fellowship. There's really nothing to it. There's no ceremonies or rituals or anything. We just eat the fish and drink the coffee. But in recognition of Dag Ba'Omer coming up this week, which is just a local tradition. I mean, we made that up, you know. It's not like other Messianic communities that I know of anyway are keeping Dag Ba'Omer somewhere. This belongs specifically to us. But in celebration of Dag Ba'Omer, it did seem groovy unto me to teach from John 21 again. So let's go to John 21. And, oh, I'd like a Dalich if somebody could toss me up a... Don't literally toss it. Thank you. John 21, I will drop in at verse 15. With breakfast on the shore. And here we're at this place where, you know, Simon Peter, still carrying the stigma and the shame of having thrice denied the master, is dealing with that as we read. You know, and as the master had said, on another occasion, he had warned, whoever denies me before men, I will also deny before my Father who is in heaven. And so after breakfast, and the disciples are attending to their nets and that sort of thing, and disentangling nets and, you know, fish from nets, and Yeshua beckons to Simon Peter, come over here, and they take a little stroll down the beach, down the rocky beach, And it says, after they had eaten, Yeshua said to Shimon Petros, Shimon ben Yonah, do you love me more than these? And that is to say, do you love me more than these other disciples love me? And the question, of course, refers back to Shimon Petros' brash declarations of loyalty at the last Seder when Yeshua had said, one of you will betray me. He said, Master, I'm ready to go to both prison and to death with you. And he swore that even though others might, he said, that he never would betray him. And as it turned out, the others had not denied the master that evening, as Simon Peter did three times, making three declarations. I do not know him. I swear to you, I do not know him. And he affirmed this three times. I don't know the man. And so, recalling this failure of loyalty, recalling this boast that he had made, rather than making any further boasts about loving him more than these others, he only replies very simply, he says, yes, my master, you know that I love you. And he said to him, shepherd my lambs. And the ensuing dialogue between Simon Peter and Yeshua has led to innumerable sermons and commentaries, all of them pointing out that while Yeshua asks, do you agapao me, do you agape love me, Simon Peter responds, you know that I phileo you, I fraternally love you, which is like, do you love me? And Peter responds, you know I like you. Like that back and forth. I mean, you've heard these sermons before, right? I've heard them. Maybe I've taught them. I don't know. But in reality, the distinction between the two Greek words is not really that sharp. And so most scholars point out it's really just stylistic. There's no intended differentiation between the two words. It's just trying to avoid redundancy the same way we do in English. But the thing to remember is that neither Shimon Petros nor Yeshua spoke Greek. They weren't talking to each other in Greek about phileo and agape love. They were all ahavti. It was all ahava. It's love, love, love. That's right. So you gotta, whatever sermons you heard about that, just put them out of your mind. Just put them out of your mind and read it in the Hebrew. So going on, it says, Vayomer elav, O dapa'am Shimon ben Yonah. No, I won't do that to you. So going on, he says, Yeshua said to him, Shimon ben Yonah, do you love me? And he said to him, yes, my master, you know that I love you. And he said to him, guide my flock. And he said to him a third time, Shimon ben Yonah, do you love me? And Petros was grieved that he said, do you love me a third time? So he said to him, my master, you know everything, and you know that I love you. And Yeshua said to him, shepherd my flock. The threefold repetition, nevertheless, is significant in that it does correspond to the three denials, right? The master says, do you love me three times? Just as Simon Peter had said, I do not know the man. I don't know him three times. And I think it's significant in that Raymond Brown points this out, that it corresponds to that oral notarization that was part of rabbinic culture of the day. Do you love me? Hain. Do you love me? Hain. Do you love me? Hain. Three times, three repetitions. I think so. Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? And this vision of love for the master, love for Yeshua, is where it's at. It's love. Love is all you need. And the Apostle John says that if we love one another, it's sufficient. Isn't that beautiful? He says, when he was very old, you know the story, he was very old, I've told it many times. And he says, and his disciples say, why do you always say that? Why don't you teach us something new? And he says, oh, if you get that, it's sufficient. The greatest commandment is to love God. The second is like it. Love your neighbor. And the new commandment, the new mitzvah, is love one another as the Master loved us. So, that's how people know us. They recognize us everywhere we go. We go to the grocery store, you go to the barber, people are like, that's a disciple of the Master. I can tell by his love. We live a halakha of love. Love for God, love for neighbor, love for brother, love your sister. The true life of Torah, we have learned, is a gift of love. The true life of a disciple of Jesus is a life of love, shaped and governed by love. Our congregations, our communities of faith, and most of all, our families, of course, should be sanctuaries of love. Love of father, love of mother, love of husband, love of wife, love of children, love of brothers, love of sisters, and then it extends out from there to extended family, of course. But above all, love of the Master as he taught us to prioritize him in love. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. He who loves husband or wife more than me is not worthy of me. So I've taught you before that we learn from this that we must prioritize our love for Yeshua, our love for Jesus, over other loves. And that our love for Jesus is the portal whereby we love Hashem, whereby we love God, and are loved by God, and known by God, and by which we know God. And if we will keep this mitzvah, this commandment to love God, as it says, you shall love the Lord your God, we must love the Master. As the Apostle John says, whoever loves the Father loves the child born of him. So, why must we love the Master more than our loved ones? Because love for the Master is the avenue. It is a tributary for the love of God. And therefore, it is no less demanding than our whole heart, our whole soul, and our whole being. That's the mitzvah. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your being. And it's so love of the Master, we're talking about this relationship, this flow of the love of God through the Son. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. And we experience this love and return this love through the Master. So he says, do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? Three times. You can be religious, and you can be messianic, and you can be Christian, but you cannot be a real disciple if you do not love the Master. And we have to ask ourselves this question from time to time, don't we? I think, you know, it was hard for me as a kid to understand loving the Master, you know, because it was hard for me. I thought, you know, it's kind of like, well, you know, I respect him. You respect him. He sacrificed himself for me. You know, I respect that. You know, I'm grateful. I feel gratitude. Gratitude, yes. But love is really personal. Love, you know someone. You know, love is... It's hard to love, and especially as Jesus becomes more and more ethereal and abstract, it's harder and harder to formulate that and love. You know where I learned love? Honestly, I learned love for the Master from Chassidus. That's where I learned it, because when I learned how the Hasidim love their Rebbe, how they just hang on the Rebbe's teaching and revere the Rebbe and encircle him, their lives around this one tzaddik, this one Rebbe, and they are his disciples. And that's what we're talking about. That's the soil of the New Testament. And so that's where I learned this concept of love. Because, of course, I love Jesus. Who doesn't love Jesus? I mean, right? What kind of person doesn't love Jesus? I mean, what kind of fascist are we talking about here that doesn't love Jesus? I mean, you're going to like, you don't love Jesus? And now what are you? I suppose Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny are out too. You know, but I'll tell you what. It's not that easy to love a guy you never actually met, is it? And frankly, sometimes it's hard to identify with him. he's like on a different level or something. So usually it begins with some sort of sense of obligation, you know, like we're told, you should love him because he died for you, right? Which it seems remote and abstract and hard to wrap your mind around. You know, yes, he died for me 2,000 years ago. And, you know, I think that's where it starts for a lot of us. The guy on the cross. Guilted love. We should love him. How do you really love the Master? How do you really fall in love with Jesus? I think you would have to ask that question, the same question about anyone. How do you really fall in love with anyone? And the answer is to fall in love with someone, you really have to know them. You really have to know them for all that they are. Is it possible to fall in love with a photograph? Not really. No. You could have an initial spark of attraction, but love is deeper. Love is experiential. Love is more than that. And so the solution, if we want to love the Master, is to get to know him. And how do we get to know him? We get to know him primarily through the Gospels, through his words and his deeds. Okay? So primarily through the Gospels. That's the avenue to know him. But there's more to it than that. Because he has said that his disciples are his friends and his body. And so through his disciples, we actually experience Yeshua. And so as we love one another, we are in fact learning to love the Master as we love his disciples. Though you have not seen him, you love him, Peter says. And so this prioritization of love for Yeshua, I want to think about a little bit. I mean, would a man, say that you're a man of over a household and you have a wife, what man would hesitate to lay down his life for his wife whom he loves, or his son or his daughter? Of course, we would do that. Well, disciples are to love the Master with that same intensity of love, but a deeper and greater love. So in other words, to be willing to lay down our lives for Yeshua. That's the calling if we are going to love him above our son, daughter, mother, father, brother, sister, husband, wife. And what that looks like throwing your life away for Yeshua. That might look like being something of a religious fanatic to love Jesus that much, that you would be willing to waste your life. If a man was to spend all the wealth of his household on love, would he not be utterly despised? I think it says something like that in Song of Songs. But it's appropriate. Probably, if we are honest, we are not able to say yes to that kind of love. But the Master says, if God were your Father, you would love me, for I proceeded forth and have come from God. for I have not even come on my own initiative, but he sent me. And the end result of loving Yeshua is to be loved by God and to love God. Paul Philip Levertov points out that a man loves someone who loves his children. And this is true. If you want to get, you know, if you want to get on someone's good side, what you do is you should go to them and say, you know, your kids are the best. I love your kids. I just, you know, I adore your children. You know, and then who's not going to like this person? You know, I like that guy. He likes my kids, right? Well, okay, maybe it's the same principle. Maybe the same principle applies. Paul Philip Levertov puts this in the place of loving the children of God, that if we love the children of God, we speak well of the children of God, of one another, then we incur the Father's love. But so too with the Son of God. So the love for the Master is not separate from the love for God. How does one love him? How does one love Yeshua? Remember this. He made this very clear to us. He said at his last Seder, he who has my commandments and keeps them is the one who loves me. He who loves me will be loved by my Father. And I will love him and disclose myself to him. Please, Lord. And then again, if anyone loves me, he will keep my word. My Father will love him. And we will come to him and make our abode with him. He who does not love me does not keep my words. And the word which you hear is not mine, but the Father's who sent me. Those are his words at the last Seder. And love for the Master, then, this love for Yeshua is not really different than any other kind of love in your life. It's like any relationship. If it's going to survive, it needs to be nourished, it needs to be cherished, and it needs to be protected, it needs to be developed, and when it's not, it can grow cold. Through the hands of the beloved disciple, the glorified Yeshua sent an epistle to the church at Ephesus saying, and you know, the church at Ephesus, Paul had been there how many years? 2 years, 3 years, something like that. Paul was in Ephesus. And after Paul, there was Timothy. That was Timothy's church. Oh, John the Apostle settles in Ephesus. He's in Ephesus. So they have some pretty solid leadership in place in Ephesus, right? So he sends to the assembly at Ephesus and he says, you guys are great, but I have this against you. You've forgotten your first love. You left your first love. And he says, therefore, remember from where you have fallen and repent and do the deeds that you did at first. So the message that we learn from Ephesus is that even with the best of intentions and the best resources and the best teaching, love can still grow cold. And the Master warned his disciples, because of Torahlessness, most people's love will grow cold. That's a quote of Yeshua. So it's easy for our love to grow cool in every relationship, to grow distant. But especially when there's absence, you know, and you have to say, well, you know, for, you know, you want to keep this love and this spiritual connection, you could drop in once in a while, you know, maybe send an email or something. You know, he's absent, and we should feel that absence. That should be like a hole in our heart. His absence, just like if you have a loved one that's away from you, and you know, you feel a hole in your heart, or when you're bereaved of someone, it's a hole in your heart, right? And we should feel the same for the Master. There's an emptiness until he returns, but there's romance even in that that absence, like the Irish girl who's standing at the sea waiting for her husband to return. You know, it's like every Irish ballad you've ever heard. There's romance in that idea of absence and anticipation of reconnecting. And then when this flame is burning, this flame of love, which is pure love, and then we consider the story of the gospel and his suffering, and then it's very different. When we have this relationship established and we come around Passover like we did last week, and we come around Passover and we already have this relationship and then look at his suffering, it's a very different approach than saying, look at his suffering, you should love this guy. But when it's your loved one who's suffering, it feels very different, very different. That's what I'm talking about. When the apostle wrote to the Ephesians and he said to them, oh, this is a great passage. Ephesians chapter 6. I like the way that... Sometimes I don't like the English Standard Version, but in this case, I very much like the way he put this. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 23, when he says, peace be to the brothers. How great is that? Peace be to the brothers. That's classic. Peace be to the brothers and love with faith. From God the Father and from the Lord Jesus Christ. Grace be with all who love our Lord Jesus Christ with love incorruptible. That's the way I'd like to close all my letters too. That's great. I'll send you an email and it's going to say that at the bottom. It's going to be peace be to the brothers. We learn from Ephesians here though that Paul expects that we should, as disciples, love the Master. He says, grace be to all who love the Master with love incorruptible. Which I thought is an interesting turn of phrase. What is something that's incorruptible? Matzah, we know that. But something corruptible is something transient, something fading. It's human. It's like human love. It blooms, it withers. You know, it's spring, it's fall, it's excited, it's fresh, it fails, it's disappointed, it's hot, it's cold. You know, it waxes, it wanes. That's corruptible love. It's, in other words, subject to change, subject to mood, subject to circumstance. It is circumstantial. But our love for the Messiah is supposed to be beyond corruption, not subject to change, not subject to decay. We learned that our love for the Master is then primarily manifest through our obedience to his words and to our submission to his Father's Torah, as he taught us in John 14. He said, he who has my commandments and keeps them is the one who loves me, and so on. And many other similar passages where he says the same. So today, I thought it would be good, as we remember Peter on the shore with the Master at Dag Ba'Omer, I thought it would be good to remind all of us of this beckoning call to fall in love. To fall in love again, or perhaps even for the very first time. Have you ever thought about your obligation to love Jesus? So I'm beckoning you to sell out for him and to prioritize your loves and your life around him, higher than all other loves. Because this is the flame of love for which you would sacrifice everything. Not for what he can give you, not because you love forgiveness or love to be forgiven, not because you love eternal life, not because you love streets of gold or pearly gates, but simply for the mad, insane love of Christ, the love of Messiah, the love of Yeshua, the Son of David, the King of Israel. Love for the sake of love. May you love him. with an incorruptible love. And may you know his love, and through him, then, may the love of God utterly possess you. So you say, he says, do you love me? And we all say, Hain. Do you love me? And we all say, Hain. I mean, and then he says, do you love me? And we all say, Hain. Yes, we do.
Take on my yoke and learn from me and find rest for your soul.